what to think either, Cassidy said. Seems like we should give him privacy, though. It's not like any of us knew her all that well, unless you did, Leah May.
Not really, Leah May said. We were in the same grade, but I mostly hung out with Jameson when I was here summers. I didn't run around with Callie all that much.
Did anyone know about her guy? Scarlett asked. Because I sure as hell didn't. Not that I would have. I probably seemed more like a little tag-along kid to her, not someone she'd confide in.
I don't know either, Cassidy said. Leah May shook her head.
Me neither.
Callie was my age as well, just like Leah May, but none of them looked to me to ask if Callie had shared her secret boyfriend with me. I'd socialized because Cassidy had insisted, more than because I'd wanted to, especially back in high school. I never sought out friendships with the other girls my age. They were fine. Girls like Callie Kendall and Leah May Larkin had always been nice to me. But I didn't have the need for a best friend or a squad, as they said. I'd had my parents and my sister, and by extension I'd had Scarlett. All the Bodines, really. They'd always been enough. More than enough sometimes.
I guess it goes to show you never know what's going on behind closed doors, Cassidy said. People can hide all sorts of things if they have a mind to.
Maybe all that stuff about her being troubled and depressed was true, Scarlett said. Her parents kept insisting on it. I suppose they'd have known. We only saw her summers and some holidays. They were with her day in, day out. Maybe that had something to do with why she ran away.
She could have been hiding all sorts of things from the rest of us, Leah May said.
I didn't have a hard time believing that Callie Kendall had disappeared because she'd run off with a man she'd met online. I hadn't known Callie well enough to judge whether that was consistent with her character. But I'd seen many of the girls I knew make bad decisions when it came to men. A teenage girl getting caught up with a guy who turned out to be trouble was common. Even I hadn't been immune to that. That wasn't what was tickling the back of my mind every time I thought about Callie. Something was. I'd just been too distracted by George to put much thought into it. Something about her story seemed off, I said.
You think? Scarlett asked. What part?
I haven't figured it out yet. I've had my mind on other things.
Like your big, sexy boyfriend, Scarlett said.
My cheeks warmed and I kept my eyes firmly on the pages of my magazine.
Lordy, Junebug, seeing you blush over a guy is both bizarre and adorable, Scarlett said. You really like him, don't you?
Of course I do. I wouldn't be dating him otherwise. I flipped the page, trying to keep my voice passive, but a flare of excitement bubbled up inside me. He's having his pet rabbit brought to bootleg in a few days.
He's introducing you to his bunny? Scarlett asked. Things really are getting serious.
Was that sarcasm? I asked. I didn't usually understand sarcasm.
No, I'm being serious, Scarlett said.
I think it's cute, Cassidy said. Daddy likes him too, and not just because he's a football player.
Was, I corrected. He's no longer playing professional football.
How's he doing with that? Leah May asked. Is he having a hard time adjusting?
He's doing well. George is... I paused, thinking about my answer. He's a relaxed sort of person. It's one of the things I admire about him. He thinks things through and doesn't get worked up if it isn't necessary. He knew his career was coming to an end, and he accepted the change in his employment with a great deal of aplomb.
Good for him, Leah May said.
Scarlett said. Sounds kind of boring. No offense intended, Junie. Oh, he's not the least bit boring, I said. He's extremely interesting and intelligent.
Guess there's more to him than football, Cassidy said.
I wasn't good at reading people, but I could see the warmth in Cassidy's eyes when she smiled at me. She was being genuine. Yes, that's correct. There is a lot more to him. The conversation moved on to other topics as we got our facials and massages. I listened idly, adding a comment or two when I felt I had something to say. Strangely, I wanted to keep talking. about George, specifically. But I didn't find room in the conversation to interject. And it wasn't his stats that sat on the tip of my tongue. He was so much more than his numbers. I could have talked about the conversations we'd had, the way his huge hands felt when they enveloped mine. I could have told them any number of things that had nothing to do with football or statistics. When we finished, we all got dressed and headed outside. Cassidy had a text from Bowie. He says they're down at the lake. She frowned at her phone. What are they doing down there? I thought they'd be at the lookout or something. Didn't they go to Build-A-Shine? Leah May asked.
Cass, why is Tom Hammond's trebuchet down there? Scarlet asked, pointing toward the beach. From here, we had a clear view straight down to the beach. And sitting there at the water's edge was the trebuchet Tom Hammond had built. I'd seen it in action plenty of times. All of Bootleg had turned out for its inaugural toss, and since then he'd launched all sorts of things across his field.
Oh, my God, they can't be, Cassidy said. Scarlet's mouth hung open.
I think they are. They wouldn't, would they? Leah May asked.
It makes some sense, Cassidy said. He is too big, even for all of them. I squinted, trying to see what was going on at the lake. What are you talking about?
Let's go, Cassidy said.
We raced down the street with Scarlet leading the way. The cool air stung my cheeks, my skin sensitive after the facial. The Bodine men were indeed standing around the big wooden structure. It was on wheels and could be pulled by a tractor. But why had Tom Hammond brought it down here? And where was George?
My second question was answered when George staggered out from behind one of the wooden supports. He splayed his big hand against the side of the trebuchet and leaned against it like he was having trouble holding himself up.
He had a mason jar in his other hand, and by the expression on his face and the way he leaned to the side, I could tell he'd had his fair share of moonshine. Bowie slapped him on the shoulder and took the drink out of his hand. Scarlet stopped at the edge of the sand and flung her arms wide to keep the rest of us from passing her.
Best to just let it happen.
Bowie leaned closer to George as he set down the mason jar and said something too quietly for me to hear. Both men laughed. I narrowed my eyes. Bowie was suspiciously steady on his feet. He was a bootlegger through and through, so of course the man could hold his liquor. Maybe George had just gotten a little carried away and Bowie hadn't.
Now! Bowie shouted.
Gibson, Jonah, Jameson, and Devlin all raced to George, letting their drinks drop to the ground. They grabbed him by the arms and legs while Gibson pushed against his shoulders from behind.
What's going on?
George asked, his words slurring. They muscled him closer to the replica siege engine, and Gibson fastened what looked like a harness onto him.
Hold still, big guy,
Bowie said, his voice strained. George tilted to the left.
What are you doing?
He secure Gibbs,
Bowie asked. Gibson pulled on a strap.
He's good.
Jameson let go and grabbed a white motorcycle helmet, then forced it down over George's head while the rest of the men held him still. What are they doing? I asked.
What is this?
George asked, making a half-hearted attempt to grab the helmet. Gibson and Jameson held his arms down.
Ordinarily, we'd just toss your ass in the lake, Bowie said. It's a thing that needs to happen if you're going to be courting June. I'm sure you understand. But you're too damn big. We didn't think we could get you down the dock, let alone pick you up to toss you in. So we came up with an alternative.
Cassidy, what are they doing? I asked again, my sense of alarm increasing.
Tossing him in the lake.
Cassidy's voice was very matter-of-fact. That's not tossing, I said. That machine is going to launch him into the lake.
Sure is, Scarlet said.
Leah May covered her mouth with her hand and her eyes widened.
Lie down now, Bowie was saying to George. Good. Come on, all the way.
But, I sputtered, struggling to get any words out. But, why? Cassidy turned to me.
Because, Junie,
He made his intentions with you known. That means the Bodines have to dunk him in the lake. It's what they do.
They did it to Dev, Scarlet said. Right off my dock. But I'm not... He's not... I don't understand.
An odd sense of warmth spread through my chest and up my throat. They're doing that for me?
George was lying down, or at least on his back beneath the large arm of the trebuchet. The Bodines were still holding him down.
You bet they are, Cassidy said.
The ridiculousness of what I was seeing seemed to fade, replaced by a simple realization. The Bodines were throwing George in the lake because he wanted to date me.
I hadn't been this happy since George said he wanted me to meet his rabbit.
We ready?
Tom stepped up, ready to release the rope.
This is surprisingly elaborate, I said, more to myself than anyone else nearby.
They've outdone themselves with this one, Cassidy said.
Go!
The shout came from several of the Bodines, I wasn't sure which, and the men all jumped back. Tom released the rope, the weight on one end went down, and George went up. And up. And over. George yelled as he flew through the air in a tall arc. Their trajectory was impressive. The men all cheered as he fell, whooping and hollering and high-fiving.
Wait! I shouted, fear making my heart race. Is he intoxicated? He'll drown!
Don't worry, Junie, we already thought of that,
Jameson hollered back.
Nash and Buck are both out there in boats ready to rescue him.
He'll be fine,
Gibson said, flashing me a rare smile. George hit the water with a splash and the cheers resumed. I raced down to the edge of the lake, and sure enough, Nash and Buck were both rowing toward the figure bobbing in the water. His white helmet was visible. He was probably fine.
Chapter 15, June. The trebuchet became a bootleg lakefront phenomenon, for the rest of the afternoon at least. A steady stream of people lined up, the cold be damned, to take a turn, until Freddy Sleeth belly flopped so hard he came out with two black eyes and a broken nose. Then my dad and Mayor Hornsblatt declared it too dangerous for human projectiles and made Tom take it back to his place. A procession of mourners followed his tractor as Tom towed it back to the Hammond farm. It looked like a funeral march. Men removed their hats out of respect. Tom managed to turn everything around that night by throwing a big bonfire and launching an old Volkswagen Beetle across his field. George had not only survived the inaugural lake launch, he'd become even more of a celebrity for it. The story grew in the telling, and within a few days people were saying he'd been thrown clear to the far bank. Some had him skipping across the surface like a rock. Still others said he'd sliced into the water like an Olympic diver, barely making a splash. The truth was, he'd come out of the water disoriented, but sober as an entire church choir. And he flinched whenever any of the Bodines got near him. What he didn't realize was that he was one of us now. He wouldn't get launched into the lake again, as long as he didn't do anything to hurt me. Which was such a strange and archaic thing, I couldn't understand why it made me so happy. What business was it of theirs who I dated or how our relationship turned out? For once in my life, I didn't overthink it. This was Bootleg Springs. It was how we did things. George called the next Friday morning to let me know his assistant, Andrea Wilson, was driving out to Bootleg that afternoon with his pet rabbit. That made me inexplicably happy as well, although it was clear to me the ideal pet was a pot-bellied pig, for a variety of reasons. George's rabbit was obviously important to him, and his excitement over seeing his small mammal and introducing me to her was infectious. In other words, I was excited too. A silver SUV was parked outside his rental when I arrived. I went to the front door and knocked.
Hey, Junebug.
He pulled me inside, his hands around my waist, and leaned down for a kiss. I completely forgot about the fact that someone else was here. George kissing me had a tendency to make my mind go blank. But the sound of a throat clearing made me jump. George appeared nonplussed. He grinned at me, then led me inside, his hand on the small of my back.
Perfect timing. Andrea just got here. Andrea, this is June Tucker. June, Andrea Wilson.
Andrea reminded me of Leah May, tall and thin with wavy blonde hair and expertly applied makeup. Her clothes were stylish, a crisp blouse and pair of dark slacks, high heels. She pursed her red lips and smiled. Nice to meet you. I held out my hand to shake. I was an expert handshaker. I'd been drilled by Cassidy and my dad on the proper technique, solid grip, but not too hard, shake twice, until I could have done it in my sleep.
You too.
Andrea shook my hand, and her eyes flicked over me, like she was sizing me up. Then her gaze moved to George.
I didn't realize you were going to have company. I actually have some things to go over with you, if you have time.
I'd be the first to admit, I was not usually adept at reading nonverbal cues. What Andrea said seemed innocuous enough. George was her boss, and he'd been out of town for a while. It made sense that she'd want to take advantage of being in the same place to review any necessary items on her list. But her body language and tone of voice told a completely different story. This woman did not like me, and she did not want me here.
That's no problem. June and I don't have plans. Let me just get Mello situated.
Andrea shot daggers with her eyes in my direction. I mentally added this to the list of firsts I was experiencing with George. I'd never had a woman look at me with envy before, at least never that I'd been aware of. It was disconcerting. George went to the kitchen table where a small cage sat. At first, I thought perhaps Andrea had forgotten the rabbit. There didn't appear to be anything inside. He reached in and produced a little scrap of fur, cradling it in the palm of one of his large hands. It wasn't a rabbit. It was a tiny white bunny. He held Mello up to his face, and her little nose wiggled as it touched his. She was so small she barely seemed real. Her fur was pure white, her eyes icy blue. There was black around her eyes that gave the impression she was wearing eyeliner. But it was her size and the care with which George held her that had my insides turn into mush.
"Oh," I breathed. "She's so cute."
George beamed at me.
"Isn't she? She's a Netherland dwarf. Hi, my little one. I missed you."
He nuzzled her against his cheek, and my ovaries suddenly burst into song, declaring their presence in my body. I'd never in my life felt an urge to procreate, but watching this man snuggle a tiny white bunny made me desperate to have all his babies.
"Do you want to hold her?"
He held her out toward me.
Okay.
I cupped my hands, and he gently transferred Mello into my grasp. She barely weighed anything, just a little tuft of softness. The pads of her feet felt like velvet, and her tiny nose wiggled as she sniffed her new surroundings.
"She's used to being handled a lot," he said. "She won't jump out of your hands or anything."
Holding her up so I could see her face, I brought her closer. She inched forward, and her sweet little bunny nose tickled against my skin, making me giggle.
"Good girl, Mello," he said. "I knew she'd like you."
Andrea cleared her throat again.
GT, it's a long drive.
Sure.
He scooped Mello out of my hands and took a seat at the table, still holding her.
"What you got for me?"
Andrea shot me a glare that George didn't appear to see. He was too busy getting Mello situated in his lap. I decided to sit at the table with him. He had business to attend to, but he hadn't asked me to leave.
"I need some signatures."
She grabbed a messenger bag and pulled out some files, then set them on the table in front of him.
"Sure."
I grabbed a pen off the counter behind me and handed it to him. He rewarded me with that dimply grin of his.
"Thanks."
Another throat clear from Andrea. She opened a file and flipped through a few pages.
"Here."
George signed. Andrea flipped through a few more.
"Here."
He signed again. I glanced over at Mello's cage. "She's out of water."
What's that?
George asked as he signed another document. Mellow doesn't have any water. The cage was nearest to me, so I scooted it closer. I wasn't familiar with Mellow's feeding schedule, but there was no sign of food. More bothersome, in my opinion, was the bone-dry water bottle.
Uh-oh, little one. Are you thirsty?
George held her up to his face again.
Can you get her some water, Andrea? That should be kept full at all times.
Andrea rolled her eyes as she stood. She's fine. I unhooked the water bottle and handed it to Andrea. Our eyes met, and there was no mistaking the flash of heat in her gaze. She took the bottle to the sink. George thumbed through the paperwork while Andrea refilled Mello's water. It bothered me that he wasn't reading what he was signing. That was on my list of things you never do, right up there with drinking more than one cup of Sunny Fulson's Peach Cobbler Moonshine or sticking a fork in a light socket. The kind of thing everyone knows you should avoid. Andrea got the water bottle reattached, and George gently set Mello in her cage. She scurried to the spout and drank.
Poor little nugget, George said. You were thirsty.
It bothered me deeply that Andrea had let Mello run out of water, although logically I didn't understand why. Was it simply that the animal's needs hadn't been met? A domesticated animal should always have a supply of water. They lack the capacity to communicate their needs to the humans responsible for their care.
I realize pets need water, Andrea said. She looks all right, George said.
Andrea collected the files and put them back in her bag.
I have a long drive. Unless you need me to find a pet store to get her food, I should go.
Even I could hear the sarcasm in her tone, but George didn't seem to.
No, I'll handle it. Thanks for bringing her out, Andrea. Appreciate it.
Andrea's eyes flicked between me and George again.
No problem. It's my job.
George stood and walked her out. I waited at the table, watching Mello drink. When she finally stopped, she seemed happier, which was probably a figment of my imagination, as I didn't think rabbits could express human emotions.
What do you think?
George asked.
Isn't she a sweetheart?
No, your assistant exhibits no qualities that would justify calling her sweet. He laughed.
No, I mean mellow.
Oh, then yes, she's exceedingly sweet.
I let her run around at home, so I just need to bunny-proof a little bit. Then we can let her out.
I followed George into the living room. He started pulling cords off the floor and picked up a scrap of paper that had fallen. What did Andrea have you sign? He was on his hands and knees, checking around the small TV stand.
What?
You signed a number of papers. I'm wondering what they were.
Oh, I'm not sure exactly. There's been a lot of paperwork as I transition from being on the active roster to retirement. There's the pension and insurance changes, things like that. Andrea has it all organized for me.
But you shouldn't sign things you haven't read.
It's fine, Junebug. I pay Andrea to read it for me.
That seemed like a shockingly terrible idea.
You can't do that.
Why not?
She didn't even make sure Mello had water.
He paused, still on his hands and knees, and looked up at me.
What are you talking about?
Mello's water bottle was completely dry. Not just out of water, dry, George. If she can't be trusted to take proper care of that tiny, helpless bunny, how can you entrust her with things like contracts and your finances?
June, she's worked for me for years.
I crossed my arms. I don't trust her.
You just met her. I don't think you need to be making snap judgments about her based on one little mistake. She's not an animal person.
I'm simply pointing out that if you're going to put so much of your life, including your money, in a person's hands, they ought to at least have the ability to care for an 18-ounce domesticated mammal. He stood and crossed his arms.
What's this really about? Don't tell me you're going to pull the jealousy thing. I know Andrea's pretty, but you don't need to be like that.
My eyes widened. Hearing him call her pretty felt like a blow to the stomach. I'm hardly envious.
The woman's not even smart enough to realize when a water bottle is empty. Besides, of the two women in this room, I wasn't the one glaring.
Glaring? Andrea wasn't glaring at you.
She most certainly was.
Well, you did call her out on the water being empty.
I pointed out a simple fact, and the well-being of your pet was at stake.
Oh my God, June, he said. Chill out about it. Mello's fine. Andrea wasn't glaring at you. Why would she?
I paused, blinking at him, and that bright and twisted knot of emotions throbbed deep inside my chest. Mentally stepping back, I separated myself from the tangled jumble so I could think. It wasn't the fact that Andrea had been giving me unfriendly glances that had my stomach hurting, and I had no reason to believe George was involved in a romantic or otherwise inappropriate relationship with her. Jealousy wasn't the cause of my current state of distress. I didn't like the way he was brushing my concerns aside, like he didn't value my opinion, and it bothered me that his judgment seemed clouded. Was he so easily distracted by a pretty face? He himself had admitted his last girlfriend, maybe all his past girlfriends, had been with him for his money and fame. Why had he continued to associate with people like that? What did that say about him now? And why didn't he care that I was worried about him? My lack of relationship experience felt like a glaring hole, huge and black. I didn't like being in situations that made me feel inept. It was uncomfortable, and when I was uncomfortable, my first reaction was to retreat. I have to go.
Wait, June.
I was out the door before he could finish.
Chapter 16. George. Curling my hand around my beer, I let the icy cold bite into my palm. I was still recovering from whatever demon concoction the Bodine brothers had let me drink. Made me drink was more like it. I should have known that peach cobbler moonshine was far more potent than it tasted. It had to have been. It had mellowed me out enough that they'd coaxed me into being launched into the lake by a fucking trebuchet. Honestly, who did that? But it was also kind of awesome. I mean, who did that? Bootleg Springs, that's who. I figured they'd done their brand of hazing. I'd not only survived, something I hadn't been too sure about when I'd been sailing through the air, but I'd earned their approval, too, and I was glad for it. I liked June a lot, and it was clear these were the sort of people who took care of each other and didn't take too kindly to outsiders being untrustworthy with one of their own. What I hadn't counted on was getting into an argument with my brand new girlfriend so soon. Not just an argument, a fight that had her racing off before we could resolve anything. I blew out a breath, then took a long pull from my beer.
Rough day?
Nicolette asked. Her dark hair was pulled back in a ponytail, and she wore a t-shirt that said, "My sarcasm is thicker than my thighs." Yeah. Are you the sort of bartender that listens to everyone's problems? She shrugged as she wiped down the bar with a white cloth.
Only if you're okay with hearing you're a dumbass.
How do you know I'm being a dumbass?
If you're sitting on that stool sucking down a beer after the hangover you must have from Sonny's peach cobbler shine, you were being a dumbass about something.
Tough crowd.
I own the best bar in a town where I have to call the cops on a bunch of 80-year-old bingo players on the regular, and a bar fight is just some good fun on a Friday night.
She grinned.
You bet I'm a tough crowd.
I tipped my bottle to her. Fair point. The door swung open, and three of the reasons for my hangover strolled inside. Bowie, Jonah, and Gibson Bodine looked every bit the brothers they were. Tall, dark hair, eyes ranging from blue to gray. I knew Jonah had a different mother, but he had enough Bodine in him that there was no mistaking his parentage. I liked these guys, even though they could have killed me the other day.
GT!
Bowie slapped me on the back and hauled himself onto the stool next to me.
Hey, Nicolette, beer's for me and Jonah when you have a second. Water for Gibbs.
He turned to Gibson.
Or could she get you a nice lemonade?
Piss off, Gibson said. Sweet tea, Nick.
Jonah sat next to Bowie, and Nicolette handed them their beers. Gibson took his mason jar of sweet tea and plucked out the straw.
"There's a lot of sugar in that,"
Jonah said, gesturing toward Gibson's drink. "Beer has carbs," Gibson said with a scowl. Jonah seemed to concede his point and took a drink.
"Why are you sitting here drinking alone?"
Bowie asked. I took another pull. Got in a fight with June. Gibson and Jonah shared a look that clearly said that poor sucker.
"Already?"
Bowie asked.
"GT, I thought we made things clear. Do we need to haul your ass back down to the lake? Because I'm telling you, it took a solid week of planning to pull that off, and I don't think we can get away with it again."
"Now, hold up, Bodine," I said. "We got into a little argument. That sort of thing has to be allowed. Otherwise, you must be tossing your sister's boyfriend into the lake at least once a week. Even I've seen them argue." Bowie grinned. "We like Dev, but we still have a little fun with him from time to time. But no, you're right. Couples argue."
Gibson snorted. "Don't have to deal with that shit if you stay single."
"Amen to that," Jonah said.
Bowie scoffed. Ignore those two. They don't understand.
"Like you're some relationship expert," Gibson said. "You haven't been dating Cass that long."
"We've been through our share of ups and downs already," Bowie said, his tone even.
"Don't be a dick."
Gibson just shook his head.
"What happened?"
Bowie asked.
"My assistant brought my bunny."
"Hold up," Gibson said. "Did you just say bunny?"
"Yeah."
"I don't even know what to say to that."
Jonah stifled a laugh.
"She's my pet." "That's a surprising piece of information,"
Bowie said.
"I'd have pegged you as more of a dog person."
"I played football for 10 years. I traveled too much to have a dog. I needed a pet that could be alone a lot, but still be friendly when I was home. That's my little Marshmallow."
They all stared at me, open-mouthed. "Judge me all you want." I took a drink. "You'll see when you meet her. She's goddamn adorable." "Okay, moving on from the bunny," Bowie said. "What does this have to do with Junie?"
"My assistant Andrea brought Mello along with some paperwork for me. June met her, and it all seemed fine, but when Andrea left, June launched into this thing about how I shouldn't trust her, mostly because Andrea had forgotten to fill up Mello's water."
"June isn't prone to overreacting," Bowie said. "I have a hard time believing she was that upset over your bunny's water."
"It wasn't just that. She got on my case about not reading through all the paperwork I had to sign, but that's Andrea's job. And she said Andrea was glaring at her or something."
"Uh-oh,"
the three men said in unison.
"What?"
"Was Andrea glaring at her?" Bowie asked.
"No,"
I said.
"Had she been?
I don't think so."
"And how'd you respond to June's accusation of glaring?"
Bowie asked.
"I said I knew Andrea was pretty, but June didn't need to be jealous like that."
Bowie and Jonah both winced. Gibson shook his head like he couldn't believe he was talking to such a moron.
"Jesus, GT, you didn't really say that to her, did you?"
Bowie asked.
"Something like that," I said. "I should have left out the pretty remark, huh?"
"You think?"
Gibson asked.
"All I meant was June has absolutely no reason to be jealous of Andrea. She's worked for me for 7 years. If I was going to mess around with her, I would have done it a long time ago. We have a strictly professional relationship, and we always have."
"Look, GT, you have to be straight with June," Bowie said. "She's smarter than half this town combined, but she sees things literally. You gotta say what you mean, not assume she'll figure it out."
"That's not even the real issue,"
Gibson said. Bowie's eyebrows winged up his forehead.
"What?"
The issue is that June had a concern and you blew her off. She saw something that she thought wasn't right. She let you know. You told her she shouldn't be jealous of your pretty assistant, which basically sent the message that you weren't taking her seriously. No shit, she's mad at you. I wouldn't speak to you either. Bowie and Jonah stared at Gibson. What? He asked. That was very insightful, Gibbs, Bowie said. Although, why were you tossing shit my direction? You're aggressively single, but you're qualified to dole out relationship advice? Gibson cracked a rare smile behind his thick beard.
Coaches don't play on the field, Bo.
That's a fair point, I said, tipping my beer to Gibson. He nodded. Coach my ass, Bowie said. This is from the guy who once dated Misty Lynn Prosser.
Shut your pie hole.
Gibson finished his sweet tea, set down the jar, and stalked off toward the pool tables. That was interesting, Jonah said. Gibbs was being oddly helpful just then.
I know, Bowie said. And he told us to go easy on you when we were planning the whole lake thing.
I won't even pretend to understand that guy, Jonah said. But he doesn't hate you, GT, so you have that going for you. I knew Gibson remembered me helping him the day he'd almost hit that deer. I didn't like that he'd crashed his car, of course, although he'd already fixed some of the damage, but I didn't mind the fact that it seemed to have put Gibson in the pro-GT camp. I had a feeling not many people got that guy to like them, but I still had to figure out what to do about June. I screwed up, didn't I?
Little bit, Bowie said.
How do I fix it? I asked. My last girlfriend would have wanted diamond earrings or a designer purse. I know that's not June. Hell, it's one of the reasons I like June.
First of all, be prepared for her to show you charts and graphs that explain how she's right.
Bowie took a drink.
But I have to admit, despite the fact that I'm in love with June's sister, I don't understand Junie too well.
I got the sense that a lot of people didn't understand June very well, which seemed odd to me. She was different, but in a lot of ways that made her easy to understand. You knew where you stood with her. Of course, that didn't mean I magically knew how to handle our first fight, but at least I knew buying her presents wasn't the answer. I stared at the mouth of my beer bottle. June wasn't like other girls I'd known, but that didn't make her any less a woman. I'd hurt her feelings. Gibson had been spot on. She'd been concerned about me. She cared, and I'd brushed that aside, assuming she was jealous. Some girls played games, made you guess. Not my June bug. She'd said exactly what she meant. I just hadn't been listening carefully. I need to go talk to her.
Good luck,
Bowie and Jonah both said. Thanks. I got up from my stool and headed for the door. Gibson caught my eye, gave me a quick chin tip, which I returned. Then I went in search of my girl.
Chapter 17, June. I stared into my open refrigerator, wishing it contained something suitable. When I'd first heard about George's injury, back when he'd been nothing but a statistic on my fantasy football team, I'd been upset, and Cassidy had suggested I eat my feelings. An odd concept, to be sure, but it did contain a certain merit. Binging on carbs would spike blood sugar levels, and the resulting dip as insulin flooded the body would make one sluggish and tired. Perhaps the resulting sensation of lethargy was preferable to sadness and anxiety. Regardless of the biological mechanisms involved, I wanted carbs and fat. And thanks to my careful meal planning and living with health-conscious Jonah, I didn't have anything good. How was a girl supposed to eat her feelings if there was nothing appropriate to eat? What would Cassidy do? She'd text Scarlett. They'd do whatever it was best girlfriends did when one of them was upset about a fight with her boyfriend. And that probably included eating something delicious. I grabbed my phone and brought up Cassidy's number. If I texted her for assistance, I knew she'd come. If I wasn't mistaken, she was off today. But what did I tell her? That my boyfriend and I had argued and I was feeling a potent mix of emotions I didn't know how to process? Was he even still my boyfriend? How did I explain it all over text? I decided to call. Cassidy picked up partway through the third ring.
Hey, Junie, what's up?
Are you currently occupied?
No, not really. I just got off my shift and I'm snuggling with George. George Cat, that is.
Would you be available to assist me with the problem?
Sure. The tone of her voice changed. What's wrong?
I need to eat my feelings, and I don't have any carbs.
Junie, what are you talking about? What's the matter?
I switched my phone to my other ear. I'm having an emotional crisis. I'm not sure what to do with all the feelings I'm experiencing, and I think I need to eat.
Hang tight. We'll be right over.
We meant Cassidy would bring Scarlett, and maybe Leah May. That was fine with me. If they each brought a baked good, I'd have more options. 22 minutes later, all three women arrived. True to my prediction, all three had a box or bag. Cassidy had opted for ice cream, Scarlett had cinnamon rolls from the pop-in, and Leah May had a box of lemon squares her dad's fiancée, Betsy, had made.
Okay, Junie, Cassidy said when we'd all settled in my living room with plates and bowls of sugar and fat. What's going on?
I spooned a bite of chocolate ice cream into my mouth, not even caring that it wasn't the right time of year for this flavor. George and I had an argument, and I left. My phone buzzed on the coffee table.
That him? Scarlett asked.
Probably.
That's all right,
Cassidy said, gesturing toward my phone like she was shooing it away.
It's okay to take a little time to sort out your feelings before you talk to him. What did y'all argue about?
His bunny. And his assistant.
You're gonna have to elaborate a bit, Cassidy said.
I explained the basics of our argument.
He called her pretty? Scarlett asked.
Oh, hell no. The fact that he mentioned her attractiveness isn't why I'm upset, I said. He trusts her to handle things like his finances, and he'll sign documents she puts in front of him without reading them, but she can't remember to make sure his rabbit has water.
Could be an honest mistake, Leah May said.
Leah May Larkin someday, Bodine, you are not defending her, Scarlett said.
No, Scarlett Bodine someday, McAllister, I'm not defending her. I'm just pointing out that June might have jumped to a conclusion.
I agree with Leah May on this one, Cassidy said, and held up a hand when Scarlett glared at her.
Don't freak out, Scar. I just mean June doesn't have a lot of evidence to back up her concerns. One mistake doesn't mean she's inept as an assistant.
He still shouldn't have called her pretty, Scarlett said. And I don't mean that because a guy can't think another woman is pretty. He can. He just needs to keep it to himself. His very new girlfriend doesn't need to hear it. That's all I'm saying.
Agreed, Cassidy and Leah May both said through mouthfuls of baked goods.
Look, Junie, it sounds like y'all just had a spat, Cassidy said. A little argument. Are you worried you can't get past it? I looked at my half-finished bowl of ice cream, considering her question.
That's part of my current state of distress, yes. Did I ruin things by walking away so abruptly?
Of course not, Cassidy said.
Why don't you just go see him and talk about it?
No, she should wait for him to come to her, Scarlett said. Make him work for it.
If you want to make up with George, bring him food, Leah May said, holding up a lemon square.
You're just saying that because you're dating the second biggest sugar whore in town, Scarlett said. I bet you could get Jameson to do anything by offering him cake.
That's one way, Leah May said and licked her fingers.
That is the upside to arguing, Scarlett said. Making up?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
I glanced between the three of them. You're talking about intercourse, aren't you?
Oh, my God, Junie, stop calling it intercourse, Scarlett said, especially if you're having it.
My body tensed at the topic. They talked about their sexual relationships all the time. Girl talk, they called it. And I didn't mind, as long as it didn't involve me. I didn't want to talk about me and sex. It wasn't something I wanted to face yet. We're not having intercourse. I mean, we're not having sex.
That's fine. No one's saying you should be, Cassidy said, her voice soothing. It's up to you to decide when the time is right. But makeup sex is a beautiful thing.
A beautiful, beautiful thing, Leah May agreed. Scarlet nodded.
Lord, yes. Sometimes I pick a fight with Dev just so he'll blow my mind after we make up.
Scarlet Rose, you are evil, Cassidy said. Just remember, Scarlet said, pointing a chunk of cinnamon roll at her.
I'm the one who told you multiple orgasms were a real thing.
That they are, Leah May said. And Bodine men are experts at giving them out. Cassidy high-fived her.
Yes, girl.
I know how to solve my problem, I said, letting my spoon clatter into my bowl.
Good, Cassidy said. The ice cream helped, didn't it?
I glanced at my bowl. It had helped a little bit, as had their conversation. Not directly, but somehow the chat with my sister and her friends had helped solidify my thoughts. I knew what I needed to do. I needed to show George that I was right. 2 hours later, I was prepared with everything I needed. I'd researched 20 different celebrities, from athletes to actors, who'd been taken advantage of by agents, managers, and personal assistants. I'd sorted through their stories for the elements they had in common and charted them on several graphs. Visual aids were often helpful when making a point. I was determined to show George why I had concerns about Andrea, and I had the data to back my position. The knock at my door startled me. Who was here? I hadn't called George to ask him to come over yet. I'd only just finished my research, the printouts still warm in my hand. The remnants of my carb fest with the girls sat untouched on the coffee table of my living room. I hadn't even cleaned up.
Junebug, George said through the door. Will you answer, please?
Invited or not, his timing was satisfactory. I tapped the edges of the printouts, shuffling them into a neat pile, and went to answer the door. Hello, George. He let out a breath and his shoulders relaxed. Was that relief in his expression?
I need to talk to you.
He came in and grabbed my hand, enveloping it in his larger one. I let him lead me inside. He didn't seem to notice the mess in my living room, just sank onto the couch and pulled me down next to him, still clasping my hand. I set the stack of papers in my lap.
I came to apologize, he said, meeting my gaze. His brown eyes were so clear. I hurt your feelings earlier, and I'm sorry. You were concerned about me, and I acted like I didn't care, but I do. I care about you, and I care about your opinion. And I'm sorry I didn't take what you were saying seriously.
His apology was so unexpected, and so sincere, it took the wind right out of my sails. I stared into his eyes, my burning need to be right winking out like a spent match. I was still concerned about Andrea. That hadn't changed in the minute or so since he'd arrived. But maybe, just maybe, the facts weren't the most important thing in this situation. The data wasn't the point. He was. I pulled my hand back from his and grabbed the stack of papers as I stood. George watched as I walked over to the trash and tossed them in. I accept your apology, I said, brushing my hands together. And I apologize for my part in our dispute. I showed a lack of faith in your judgment. You're an intelligent man, one I admire a great deal. I could have expressed my concerns in a manner that wasn't so harsh.
What was that you threw away?
He asked. I'd prepared documentation to prove my point. His mouth turned up in a smile.
Let me guess, charts and graphs?
Yes. How did you know? You only saw the cover page.
You aren't going to show me?
he asked.
No.
He laughed and shook his head.
Come here.
I joined him on the couch and he kissed me. A deep, slow kiss that had me thinking about what the girls had said regarding makeup sex. We weren't there yet, but I got an inkling of what they'd meant. George and I made out on my couch, and it was incredibly satisfying.
Chapter 18, June.
In the weeks since the news about Callie Kendall had broken, most of Bootleg Springs had settled down about it. The balloons, signs, and streamers had all come down. Conversations and arguments that had once centered around the prevailing theories about her disappearance turned to other topics, although there was still a fair amount of boasting from those whose favorite theories had been the closest. Anyone who'd spouted the ran-off-with-a-boy notion was especially smug. I heard from my sister that the case files and what evidence there was had been boxed up and put in storage. She grumbled about the Hollis Corner Police Department being the ones with jurisdiction to look into the cult and the rest of Callie's story. I could tell she didn't like being kept in the dark about it. People took down the missing persons posters. Some had been pinned to walls so long the paint was faded around them, leaving bright paper-sized rectangles behind. There was an odd sense of loss mixed with relief. Callie had been found, her mystery solved. Everyone agreed it was a good end. She was alive and well. But it had ended so abruptly, it was hard to shake off over 12 years of speculation, curiosity, and hope. I had enough to keep me occupied, so that little splinter of doubt about Callie Kendall waited in the back of my brain. I knew it was there, but I didn't turn my attention to it. There was work, and I was brought in to help with a risk analysis and sales plan. And there was George. I was falling for George Thompson. The logical part of my brain recognized these strong feelings for exactly what they were, noticed them, saw their brightness, their warmth, and innate appeal. I liked these feelings, even though I was often confused by them. Why was an evening snuggling with George and Mello watching SportsCenter so much better than doing the exact same activity at home, or with my dad? Why did my heart beat faster when I knew George was coming to pick me up for a date? And the touching. I'd never been one to relish a great deal of physical contact. I liked my space, and I'd never found touch to be a compelling way to bond with other humans. Not so with George. Those enormous hands of his roamed across my body, respectfully, of course, and I loved every bit of it. Couch snuggles, hand-holding, arms around my waist. Kissing. Oh, the kissing. His kisses were so distracting, I'd never once thought to ask ahead of time if he'd flossed recently. I was curious about this newfound emotional resonance I was experiencing. I didn't understand it, but in this case, it wasn't triggering my instinct to shy away. I wanted to dive into it, experience more. George had told me more than once, "Don't think, just feel," and I wanted to. I wanted to try feeling all sorts of things. So I did what one should always do when faced with a topic about which they'd like to learn more. I went to the library. The Bootleg Springs Library was right downtown, housed in one of the oldest buildings still standing. Its brick facade was a little crumbly, but still inviting. Brand new wooden steps led up to a landing that Scarlett had fixed just last summer. She'd replaced the worn wood that had been so rotten Millie Waggle had gotten her foot stuck, pulling her shoe clean off. Inside it smelled like heaven. Leather, old paper, and a hint of lemon from the polish the librarian, Piper Redmond, liked to use on the surface of the front counter to keep it shiny. I stepped inside and took a deep breath. This library was one of my favorite places on earth. It wasn't particularly large, as far as libraries went, nor was it fancy. I'd been to others that were far more grand or housed old and important books. This library was simple, but it was home. I'd spent hours of my childhood within these walls, curled up with a book. My parents had encouraged my love of reading, but had always been puzzled by my choices. While Cassidy was reading The Babysitter's Club, I was checking out books on astronomy and physics. I read Carl Sagan's Cosmos when I was 8. I'd devoured anything that had to do with science, and later math. Cassidy had been dumbstruck when I'd brought home college math textbooks so I could do the problems for fun. My brain craved that sort of stimulation. Without it, I felt twitchy and restless. As long as I was soaking up knowledge about something, I was happy. I wandered past the nonfiction area, those shelves I knew so well, and stared at a place of unknowns. Fiction. I'd expanded my horizons beyond science texts as a young teenager when my dad had hooked me on sports. Then I'd started devouring books on sports statistics and athlete biographies. It had started with baseball. Batting averages were easy to calculate and interesting to follow. But football had excited me in a way other sports hadn't. There was an element of chance to the game that numbers couldn't account for, a brutality to it that had made it especially stimulating to follow. But reading fiction? I'd never bothered unless it had been assigned reading in school.
"Hey, June, are you looking for something in particular?"
Piper asked. Piper Redman was nothing like a stereotypical small-town librarian. She had a pixie cut that changed colors every week, more piercings than I could count, and a riot of colorful tattoos all over her body. She was a bootleg transplant, having moved here to take over the library 11 years ago. Despite her loud exterior, Piper's demeanor was subdued. She spoke softly and had read more books than anyone I'd ever known.
"Yes," I replied. "I need books with lots of feelings."
Piper tapped her finger against her lips.
"What sorts of feelings?"
"All of them." She smiled.
"Then I know just what you need."
She led me to the romance section. My first instinct was to scoff, but I knew better than to question her. She'd given me countless recommendations over the years, and she'd never once steered me wrong. If she thought I should read romance novels, I'd trust her. I waited, holding out my arm so she could deposit her selections in a growing stack for me to carry. She chose 6 books of varying thicknesses, all displaying passionate couples or attractive men on the covers.
"You can't go wrong with any of these," she said. "Fair warning, they'll rip your heart to shreds, but put it back together quite nicely."
"That sounds like the sort of book I'm looking for."
"Need help with anything else?"
she asked, depositing one more on top.
"No, these should keep me busy for a few days."
"There's more where these came from," she said.
"If you like one in particular, let me know, and I can suggest more that are similar."
"Thank you." I followed her up to the checkout counter, but paused when a title in the nonfiction section caught my eye. Crime Statistics in America, newly expanded and updated edition. I grabbed that, too, and added it to my pile. Piper scanned my books and I slid them into my tote bag, satisfied with my selections. I went home and stacked the books on my coffee table, then tucked myself into a corner of my couch. I'd planned to dive into the first of Piper's suggested romance novels, but the crime statistics book was poking at that splinter in my brain, the Callie splinter. I wasn't sure why. Callie's case was solved. There was no longer a mystery to ponder. But something about her story still bothered me. Maybe it was time to turn my brain on the problem and figure out why. Bringing up footage of one of the news stories on YouTube, I let it play in the background while I thumbed through the book on crime stats. Nothing was connecting. No flash of insight making my brain light up. And then, there it was. Neurons fired. Connections were made. I knew what had been bothering me. I just needed to do a little digging to see if I was right. George texted, letting me know he was on his way. We had plans with Cassidy and Bowie to go out on a double date. I sent a quick reply, my thoughts buzzing on the problem at hand. 12 minutes later, George arrived. He came in and I looked up, feeling dazed, like I'd just woken from a long nap.
"Hey, you," he said. "What has you so focused?"
"I'm sorry." I brushed my hair back from my face. How had it gotten so tangled? I'd only gone from the couch to the kitchen table. "I figured it out." He pulled out the chair across from me and sat.
"Figured what out?"
"What was bothering me about Callie Kendall's story."
"Oh?"
"Callie said she spent the last 12 years living with a cult outside Hollis Corner," I said. but Hollis Corner has an unusually high crime rate for its size.
How do you know?
I find anything that's a statistical anomaly to be interesting. Hollis Corner is a statistical anomaly. It's a rural community with a crime rate not explained by its population density. I first discovered it when I was running risk analysis reports for a client. Today, I saw this book at the library. I tipped the crime statistics book so he could read the cover. It reminded me.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
The higher-than-expected crime statistics extend back at least 2 decades.
In other words, Hollis Corner is a crime-ridden cesspool, and that's not new.
Precisely. My mind whirred, like a well-oiled machine, gears turning smoothly, moving from one conclusion to the next. Which means one of 2 things.
One, the cult is not a cult. It's a criminal organization.
A little jolt of excitement burst through my veins. He understood. Yes. Or the criminal activity stems from another source.
Do you know which it is?
Yes. I turned my laptop so he could see. Hollis Corner is firmly within the territory of the Free Renegades. They're officially classified by the Department of Justice as an outlaw motorcycle club. That means there's significant evidence that they are heavily involved in criminal activity.
So they're not a bunch of doctors and lawyers who like to drive Harleys and wear leather.
Another zing of excitement made my fingers tingle. Precisely. The crime rate stems from the fact that local law enforcement is largely ineffective in towns such as Hollis Corner. The Free Renegades are well known for maintaining a mafia-like grip on their locales.
Okay, I'm still with you. But what does this have to do with Callie's cult?
The Free Renegades wouldn't allow a cult to exist in their territory, I said. They would have run them out of town before they could build their compound. They don't tolerate any perceived competition, and a cult leader would be considered such.
They'd see him as a threat to their authority.
Yes.
Hmm.
He rubbed his jaw.
And I'm no cult leader, but if I was, I don't think I'd choose to put my compound in the way of a criminal biker gang. Sounds like that would mean a higher chance of the authorities sniffing around, even if the bikers didn't run them out first.
That was my thought as well.
But wait.
George got up and started pacing.
Let's think this through from another angle. What if the cult made a deal with the bikers? They paid them tribute, mafia style, for protection.
Your theory is not impossible, I said. But it is highly improbable. Cult leaders and heads of criminal organizations often have traits that make them prone to self-aggrandizement.
They have big heads, sure.
I would imagine clinical narcissism as well, but I don't have statistics on that. I'd have to look that up later. My point is, I don't think the two groups would have coexisted in the same region.
What if they were isolated? Maybe the bikers left them alone because they weren't close by.
I shook my head. The Free Renegades have an established territorial range that includes the outlying areas.
So, what are you saying?
I don't have enough evidence to draw a solid conclusion, but I think it's possible Callie Kendall was lying about where she was all those years.
George grinned. God, you're sexy when you're being smart.
I couldn't help but smile back, a little. I don't know what that has to do with the topic at hand.
You just are. I love watching that big brain of yours work.
But why do you think she'd lie? I closed my laptop, frustration leaving a knot in my stomach. I don't know. Human motivations are such a mystery to me. On the surface, her story is entirely plausible. The only reason I questioned Callie's story was her mention of Hollis Corner. I knew I'd read something about it before. George sat back down.
All right. Let's think about her motives. Why would Callie lie and say she was held prisoner by a cult?
I was hoping you'd have some ideas.
Well, maybe she's ashamed of the truth. Maybe she really just ran off with a guy, and when it didn't work out, she decided to come back to her life. But she feels bad for staying awake for so long, especially when there was so much media attention on her story.
I wished I understood people better. Maybe I should have listened to my sister and tried harder to socialize.
Or maybe she's doing it for the attention, he said.
I'm very familiar with that sort of thing.
How so?
Groupies. A lot of the reason girls chase athletes is for the attention. They want to be seen. If they're dating someone who gets media attention, they get some by being with them. It's more than that, usually. They want to be spoiled with expensive things. Those designer purses and shoes are like Girl Scout badges to them. They want to collect them and show them off. But the attention is a big deal, too.
I suspect a desire for attention is a strong motivator. But if she wasn't with the cult, where was she? And why now? Why come forward after all these years?
I don't know, he said.
Regardless of her potential motives, I'm sure about this, George. Something doesn't add up.
It bothers you when you don't understand an equation, doesn't it?
Yes, that's exactly it. This doesn't make sense, and it's more than a statistical anomaly or an aberrant data point.
Well, do you think you can put it aside long enough for dinner and a movie? We're supposed to meet Cassidy and Bowie in 10 minutes.
I closed my laptop. Surprisingly, I could. Even more surprisingly, a double date with George held more appeal than an evening spent looking up numbers and calculating probabilities. Callie's